Off the Chart with Medical Economics, a podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices today. I'm Jeff Bendix, Senior Editor of Medical Economics. One of the many effects of the COVID-19 pandemic has been to force medical practices to rethink how they provide care to their patients without face-to-face visits. For most practices, especially those in primary care, this has meant greatly expanded use of telehealth. Now, with a vaccine for COVID-19 available, the end of the pandemic may finally be in sight. But if telehealth remains an important form of care delivery, what might that mean for the business side of medical practices? And what could be some of the other lasting impacts of the pandemic on healthcare delivery? My guest today will help answer those questions. He is Ron Holder, Chief Operating Officer of the Medical Group Management Association. Among his responsibilities is helping medical practices meet the changing demands of the business environment in which they operate. Thanks for joining us today, Ron.
Thanks, Jeff. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, as I said in my introduction, probably the biggest impact of COVID-19 has been the rapid expansion of telehealth. How much of that growth do you expect to remain after the pandemic, and particularly among primary care practices, assuming that payments for healthcare visits continue at parity with in-person visits?
Yeah, well, your last part there is going to be a real kicker, obviously, is the parity of payments, and is it going to be valuable to patients and providers alike to continue that practice at whatever level? So I think most people don't expect that telehealth will continue at the level that it did during COVID. But I think that one of the things that the pandemic has taught us about telehealth is that both patients and providers alike are increasing, I guess, the trust or the value that they see with telehealth. But compared to pre-pandemic levels, we will see an increased use of telehealth. But it's not going to get anywhere near what it was during the pandemic. There's going to be certain generations and members of the population that want to see it continue at a high level. But I think the coolest thing about this, if you can say that anything was cool about, you know, the pandemic, is that we're going to see it be incorporated more for things that it makes sense. And as technology changes going forward, I think it may actually have a ripple effect that we'll be able to embrace other technological advances in remote monitoring, things like that, as they grow, that can be incorporated into telehealth as well.
Assuming that a certain percentage of medical practice visits continue as telehealth, what could be the impact on the business operations of practices? Will they require less space, fewer staff? Will there be any effect on collections, on revenue cycle management, that sort of thing?
Again, you touched on it in your first question with regards to it depends on what the payments are going to be going forward. And with the new administration in Washington and stuff, there's so much that's unknown about that right now. One thing that I would encourage practices to do with regards to the impact of telehealth in the future on business operations is to look at it in terms of opportunity cost. Practices right now, out of necessity, they converted a lot of their in-person visits, including their in-person space, the existing offices they had, into telehealth types of things. You don't need to own expensive office space in order to provide telehealth. And that's part of your question, I know. But when you look at it in terms of an opportunity cost, what we saw over the last decade pre-pandemic was primary care was always this way a little bit, but first tier specialty care started to go to where the patients were, started to put clinics in the neighborhoods and the parts of town or whatever, where the patients were that they wanted to be, because patients expected that amount of convenience. If you had insurance plans that allowed you a great amount of choice, you needed to be close to those patients, et cetera. The unfortunate side of that is that that real estate was typically more expensive than other alternatives, right? So if you have an element or a part of your practice that is telehealth, you can still serve those patients without being in the neighborhood. I think what practices are going to be, especially if they're of a size that they can get an economy of scale, is can we have physicians, nurses, registration, billing staff working from home and then utilize that space that we have to add more face-to-face providers? Because if you can't do that, then do you need to downsize your space? Are you going to have vacant space? We saw some start to transition leading up to the pandemic of practices basically eliminating the waiting room kind of concept. And during the pandemic, well, the whole concept of a waiting room is like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be around that many people, especially potentially sick people. So utilization of space is going to be different going forward, potentially. And what can you do with it, with what you have? Because it may not be that converting space within your offices, especially if that space is expensive, that is going to be a good idea to convert that to telehealth employees when they can work elsewhere for a better bottom line for your practice. Again, depending on what happens with the payments, it may be a thing that when you're assessing whether or not you want to do it, you have to independently look at the financial decisions of expanding those types of practices as well. If you layer on a percentage of overhead from a hospital system or of a large in-person practice in a really expensive part of town onto a telehealth practice, the fixed costs associated with that overhead could cripple the financials of a telehealth practice, right? And you may decide not to do it because it isn't contributing the same amount of money to your overhead. And that may be a bad decision because in a future post-pandemic economy, access is still going to grow as millennials and the generations that follow them want to have more access to the physicians. It's only going to grow with regards to the need to have other ways to have access to your healthcare providers.
What is MGMA hearing in as far as any plans to continue payment at parity with in-person visits?
I think a lot of it is actually tied to the concept of Obamacare era, accountable care organizations and stuff. And that's something that the new administration says that they want to continue to focus on and grow. And because of that, I think that you may not see a future where, you're getting paid necessarily per call. But during the pandemic, practices that had a higher percentage of value-based contracts did better than ones that were mostly fee-for-service types of contracts. And so, well, is that something that will continue on for a great amount of time? Who knows? I mean, we saw a lot of exchange participation and stuff when that first happened. Everybody and their brother started doing ACOs, participating in exchanges. But what you saw was a backup of demand and need for medical services for people that didn't have it before, and at lower payments. And a lot of practices and healthcare systems struggled as a result. But this is a shorter-term thing. So I think emerging from it, we're going to see that, value-based payment is still going to be good. And part of that will be, things that don't require as much resources from the practice's perspective, such as, remote monitoring as we go forward, monitoring of emails, queues of patient portal for the medical record. And that is a way to make sure that everybody that you have on the team working at the top of their licensure. From a payment perspective, we have our advocacy team in Washington that is continuing to make sure that, the administration in Washington understands what's going on, the need from practices. We're supporting, at least in the short term, continued payments that we've seen for telehealth visits. But who knows what's going to happen? They could, shift so much towards the ACO, Obamacare type of thing that it almost approaches capitation, at which point, what does payment parity to in-person visits matter as much in that regard?
If payment levels don't match patients' demands for telehealth, where does that leave practices?
I don't want to quote Jurassic Park here, but nature finds a way,
Yeah.
the kind of thing of if patients demand it, I really feel like legislators will listen more than to the practices or the healthcare systems, kind of thing. And it gets to a point that practices just don't want to do it anymore. They can't do it. They're losing money by doing it. Something will have to happen. There will be somebody that will step into that space and figure out how to do it in a cost-effective manner, whether it's us, whether it's the minute clinics that you see popping up, whether it's an online type of physician thing that has the ability to do it regardless of where you are, you know, national medicine instead of practice, you know, practice license along state lines. You know, who knows what will happen if that doesn't happen, but what practices will probably end up doing is you're going to see more shift towards, I said this earlier, top of licensure type of practices. Is how can we incorporate nurse practitioners and physician assistants and nurse specialists and nurses and things like that so that the physician's time, which is the most expensive person's time in almost all practices, is doing the things that have the highest value and the highest reimbursement associated with it. And it's team-based care. And you've got the people that can do the other things doing those things. Mm-hmm. That still meets the demand of the patients, but does it in a cost-effective way so that's not going to cripple the practice financially.
What trends do you anticipate in terms of staff hiring and retention after the pandemic?
I think that for a lot of the staff in medical practices, what you're going to see is because every local market tends to sort of get to an equilibrium point with regards to how they're paying their staff. You know, medical assistants sort of around this and whatever. And you know, medical assistants, nurses will sometimes move for very few cents on the dollar on an hourly basis. But coming out of the pandemic, I think other things are going to matter. It's like, was this practice known locally in the community for throwing their medical assistants and their desk staff as the first thing that they cut when they started to struggle, you know, with the pandemic? Did the physicians take a hit? Did everybody take a hit? Who took a hit? Or were there like the sacrificial lambs early on? That's something that, you know, that albatross can hang around those people's necks for a while. In the same way, I think that a shift for the markets where maybe your registration staff or medical assistants are making less than $15. I think what you're going to see is if the culture at your practice isn't good and you were only keeping those because you were paying a dollar more an hour than over here, people will leave because no one is going to, if I'm being paid right now, $5 above the minimum wage in my market. Mm-hmm. If the federal minimum wage goes to $15, you won't immediately see those specific people get their pay bumped by practices up to $5 above the new minimum wage. And there'll be this new level setting of people. And if everybody's making around $15 to $16 an hour in the market, then why shouldn't I be at a place where I'm valued by the physicians, the other members of the team, the culture's good, the benefits are good, things like that. And it's not really about that money anymore because people aren't doing that. Eventually there will be practices that shift their new minimums to a little bit above the new minimum rate wage, right? But I think that culture with regards to how you treated your teams, how you protected your teammates during the pandemic, those types of things are going to be key to be able to recruit coming out of the pandemic.
If practices see fewer patients in person, does that mean that they'll have to rethink how they measure the quality of their care and their care delivery? What will that mean for metrics?
That's something that is somewhat driven by the government, somewhat driven by the insurance plans, who also kind of take lead from Medicare sometimes. And we've got a new administration. We don't know what kind of quality things they're going to want to put in place. Yes, but we don't really know what those things are yet. Some of the things won't matter, you know, like hemoglobin A1C, the measurements like that, whether they're at home, remote monitoring, in the office, whatever, if it's not going to matter. Other things could get a little more dicey, a little more difficult. And again, the science, Nate, will catch up. There'll be more remote monitoring things that happen, technology to integrate, to send via something that plugs into your phone that monitors, you know, that you then send to your practice, your physician. All those things will then ultimately turn into sort of quality indicators and things like that. Your acute stuff is, is way further down the road with regards to any acute care, with regards to monitoring and quality metrics and stuff like that. I don't think that the pandemic is going to impact those kinds of things at all, you know, like post-surgical infection rates and things like that, because those things still happen face-to-face. They have to. But monitoring ongoing things, like I said, the hemoglobin A1C, blood pressure, it doesn't really matter where the patient is. If they're your patient, you're going to be held accountable for it in some measure and in value-based contracts going forward, I would imagine.
What do you think practices will have to do to adjust to the greater use of remote monitoring devices? It'll mean a lot more data coming in, right? Or will they be able to process that and work it and integrate it into their workflow?
I think that there's a high degree of likelihood that the majority of those practices aren't going to have to worry about the integration of that so much if they have electronic medical records and things like that. I think that the vendors for electronic medical records and the tech companies or whatever are going to handle a lot of that via interfaces and stuff, and it'll be there. You know, when you log in to check on your patient, hey, there's the most recent monitoring result or whatever for my patient. I think that the expenses will always get passed through to the practice, right? You know, so it's nothing that necessarily you might not have to pay for every patient to do it. It's just part of your fee that you're paying for your electronic medical record that then gets, you know, passed on to you when you're paying that fee. But I think that a lot of that, as it goes forward, will be handled in that way, as opposed to the docs have to worry about it themselves in their practices. But if the docs do have to worry about it in their practices, there'll be a lot that are on the leading edge and not the bleeding edge. They'll wait for other people to work out the kinks and make it easier, because there's just so much with regards to administrative burdens and all the hoops that docs have to jump through already. Unless it adds value and is easy, it's probably not going to be implemented on the front end by most practices.
At this point, is MGMA offering its members any guidance or advice on preparing for doing business and thriving in a post-pandemic environment?
The number one advice is, whether it's medical economics or MGMA at national level or state, you need to have some vehicle so that you are up to date on the current pulse of what's going on, what is happening right now, what's coming, so that you can make sure that your practice is ready for it, right? That's the number one thing. Secondly is, you know, we have things such as our MGMA stat poll, which provides pretty current feedback with regards to what our practices are experiencing, or our practice administrators, such as, you know, use of it, continued increasing use of advanced practice professionals. You do their data surveys to see, you know, how to pay some of those people, data around staffing, and, you know, use benchmarks to manage your practice. Think about what you need your practice to look like, again, to make sure people are working at the top of licensure. APP use is continuing to go through the roof. At 67% of our better performing practices were using advanced practice professionals. And among physician owned practices, that number is actually 87%. And that's gonna continue to go up. And telehealth, that's been a key strategy as telehealth has grown, is to have advanced practice professionals managing a lot of that in many, many practices. So
in the sense of screening before the patient gets on the phone or gets on the computer with the doctor?
Yeah. In larger practices may do things like having a prescription refill center that facilitates and tees up everything for the doc or the APP or whatever. Mm-hmm. Again, you want to set your structure up in a way that your most expensive resources from a labor perspective are your physicians, and after that, your advanced practice professionals. And to do so, you need to do things like that for telehealth and for in-person visits as well, to tee them up with everything that they need to do so they can be the most efficient that they can with their time with the patient. And then also if you're doing those things, it allows for there to be value during that time as well, so that the patients don't feel like the physician or the APP is rushed, right? Because they're having to, you know, do so many administrative things during their time that they can't really get to know the patient. They can't really get to know the patient's problems, those kind of things. You know, it's like you really want to have a setup in a way so that you can have good value with the patient. They feel valued. They feel like their time is important, not just yours. But in order for that to happen, you have to have a structure of staff, of medical assistants, of desk staff, of nurses, of whatever to facilitate that efficiency.
Are there any other aspects of how COVID-19 might affect COVID-19 might change medical practices that we haven't covered?
Yeah, we touched on it a little bit with regards to the concept of no waiting rooms, but you know, I think that is something of, I think that you're just going to see that going forward of less waiting room space. Figure out ways that they can, once they come in, they go straight to the exam room or whatever. Because, you know, before COVID there was Ebola. Before that there was, so there's going to be bugs that happen that people are going to be stressed about in the future. That everyone's saying, you know, hey, this COVID thing was a once in a hundred years type of bug, but still that alertness, that I guess fear that will be existing in many patients, I think that's going to hang around for a while. That they're not going to want to be in close proximity with a lot of other potentially sick people. So I think that there's going to be physical layouts that you're going to have to consider with regards to what do we need to change about how our lobbies, our registration areas. If you have a common area where patients are brought back and multiple patients at a time are all brought back to one location where they're weighed and, you know, you do your intake. Is that going to be something that people are going to want to be a part of going for? Why am I right here next to these other patients while this is going on? So those are all considerations that I think will linger for some time after we're allowed to take our masks off. And again, and you touched on it at the very beginning, is we don't know what the payments are going to do. We don't know what the new administration is going to do, but staying connected, staying on top of it, both from a local and national perspective of what changes are coming, that's going to be the most important thing that practice administrators and physician leaders can do going forward.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very helpful.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Glad to do it.
Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And be sure to visit our website at medicaleconomics.com, where you'll find all the latest news about the business of healthcare. We hope you'll listen next month for a new episode of Off the Chart with Medical Economics.